Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm...
Where do we begin?
Ron,
where do we begin?
I have never anticipated... this is probably going to be the worst podcast in history, but I have never anticipated a podcast like I do this one. I'm sitting there Wednesday night and saying, I just can't believe what I just saw.
I would do away with the education,
commerce,
and let's see. I can't. The third one, I can't. Sorry. Oops.
I can't
believe
it.
I feel like Jack Buck. I feel like Jack Buck when Kirk Gibson hit the home run.
I don't believe what I just saw.
It was the Grand Slam home run to win a World Series game, inverse of all time.
You think of major gaffes in debate history.
And
you think of Jerry Ford.
There is no Soviet domination of Eastern Europe, and there never will be under a Ford administration.
But when you think of that, that made sense. This made no sense. And in the fact that, first of all, aside from the fact that the one department he wanted to cut he couldn't think of is energy, which is his whole basis for his candidacy, because energy is going to solve all the job problems in the country.
But look, this is brain lock. It's not like he really couldn't decide which three.
No, I know.
It's there somewhere in that piece of paper he couldn't get unfolded.
But if he told
John Harwood,
the moderator, right?
The moderator from CNBC in an earlier interview that these were the three departments. That's why Harwood could sit there and go, when somebody else prompted him and said, you mean EPA? Harwood's sitting there kind of shaking his head and going, do you mean that?
If Rick Perry had been doing well in the debates all along, and you say, okay, brain freeze. Remember Jan Brewer, the governor of Arizona,
had this huge gap where she couldn't answer the question.
There was just a long, long pause.
We have did what was right for Arizona.
And everybody made fun of her, and of course she won a resounding re-election in Arizona.
Which she was
on
her way to doing anyway.
Probably.
Before that debate.
But this was after all these disastrous debate performances. Then he came back with all these bad reviews and had another bad performance. And then he said, maybe I should skip these debates altogether. And then he showed
up. That didn't play well.
No, and...
But it was the right thing to have done at that point, for him to have just said, look, this is not the best measure of my candidacy. I'm going to pick and choose and only do a few of these. That might have been a better idea.
Well, yes, and after 3 weeks of being off, maybe there was some kind of... We haven't had a debate in 3 weeks. Maybe he had some debate training or coaching in the interim.
But... Maybe, you would think.
The
other thing, and I think a lot of people have noticed this. He seems fine in the first hour. The first hour.
He didn't say much.
He plays fine in the first half. But when he comes out for the second half, he just seems to be tired or something. He seems to be brain tired. And he just hits these moments where he gets befuddled and he has nothing to say.
Well, and all the bad jokes about, Texas governors who weren't the smartest of...
George W. Bush had no kind of problems like this.
No, he did not. No, not at all.
I mean, he always had something to say in the debates. It always sounded a little bit pre-prepared, but that's what they all do. In fact, in fairness, you looked at that whole field last night, and while there were clear differences between what they were saying and while there were clear differences in their levels of preparation, all of them had fallen back on really cliched, ordinary. These are the things they've said many times before.
Regulatory burden.
Markets work.
999.
No talk about the current situation before the Committee of 12, which is coming right down to its deadline for this $1 trillion cut in the federal deficit. There was no engagement on Solyndra or Fast and Furious or any of the things that you would think would be salient right now in the minds of Republican voters, and they would want to know what these candidates had to say about those issues. There was none of that freshness at all.
I don't think we're criticizing the moderators at CNBC, because I think both John Harwood and Maria Bartiromo did very, very good jobs, except Jim Cramer was so crazy!
I don't know why they brought out Jim Cramer. I do know why they brought out Rick Santelli. Santelli, who is usually a reporter from the bond markets on CNBC. Rick Santelli has never gotten proper credit for being the first guy to throw out the phrase Tea Party. We're going to have a little Tea Party here, he said, to object to one of the early elements of the Obama economic program in 2009. And around that phrase, of course, was organized a whole movement. Of course, a lot of other things were involved in that. But he gave it its name. He gave it its early label. And he was and is oftentimes on the air expressive of that particular energy in our politics. And none of these candidates were really able to tap into that, even with Santelli asking questions last night. And I agree with you. I think that this was by far the strongest panel of interviewers, of moderators, that we've seen in any of the debates, and we've had 10 of them now.
I know we like to say, you know, winners and losers, and of course there's no question who the big loser was in Wednesday's debate, but do we say that Rick Perry's candidacy is finished? There are fewer than 60 days before the Iowa caucuses. He has ads up now in Iowa, basically pablum ads saying, you know, I'm a good guy and here's a little biographical stuff, but... Well, even if you saw the debate or not, it's all over the internet. It's all over Twitter. It's all over the TV. I mean, all Thursday morning, all you saw was the excerpt of that disastrous 53 seconds. This is how bad people saw it. Mark McKinnon, the former Bush advisor, went so far as to describe Rick Perry's performance as like a shuttle challenger, the explosion in 1986. Now, that, of course, is beyond horrific, the loss of lives and everything.
He's just talking about the way that
it's a metaphoric disaster.
Sat there watching a disaster before their eyes. Yeah.
So before we leave this Hindenburg of a debate, is he finished?
I believe there is 90% or 95% chance that his fundraising absolutely tanks after this. And
you're welcome.
No one writes any checks for Rick Perry anymore because you're throwing bad money after good. So that's probably what's going to end his candidacy. He will show up for the debate in South Carolina this weekend, obviously has to, and he will do the best he can. And
he had been making jokes, self-deprecating jokes about the, you know, I'm glad I wore boots because I sure stepped in it. Yeah.
That doesn't help.
No.
It just shows that he's not a person without awareness that he has done a bad job. That's not enough. So I would say 90%, 95% he's done now, and it's just a question of deciding where to fall down. Although we have seen miracle comebacks in our politics. A lot of people in 1991 thought that the combination of draft dodging and Jennifer Flowers and all those stories about philandering were going to do in a young guy named Bill Clinton, who was the governor of Arkansas. And that's why finishing second in New Hampshire enabled him to call himself
the comeback kid.
I will predict if Rick Perry can finish second in Iowa or New Hampshire, he can call himself the comeback kid.
Lots of luck with that, pal. But I think also is the fact is if there's anybody who really appreciated Rick Perry's performance, it was Herman Cain. I mean, Herman Cain was the subject of newspaper headlines for 9-10 days in a row, women coming forth about harassment claims that go back when he was ahead of the NRA, the National Restaurant Association, explain that to
which
me.
Is now the most famous NRA in the country.
Exactly, the first one that hurts the Republican Party. And yet, the interesting thing about Cain is that the suggestions of contrition, let alone guilt, in anything he said, he's gone on Jimmy Kimmel, for goodness sakes.
Total denial. And now he's going to do David Letterman. Right. And the fact that he is choosing comedy shows, late-night comedy shows, to make his defense, I think shows several things, including a kind of savvy, that one of the things that kills you when you get exposed to this kind of allegations of this kind, what kills you is not the news reports, which try to be as balanced as possible. It's the comedians making fun of you every night, relentlessly, night after night after night. And David Letterman and Jimmy Kimmel and all the rest of them have been doing that. So he goes on their shows to try to show people that maybe all that stuff isn't true, and also to show people maybe they like him anyway, which is how Bill Clinton, to some large degree, got away with all of his peccadilloes.
For all the inappropriate and silly jokes that you and I have made over the years, and many of which we probably would want to take back.
You're left out unfunny.
And unfunny jokes. There's nothing funny about sexual harassment. Several things hit me. First of all, Gloria Allred, who comes out and talks about, well, I guess that's what Herman came in by his stimulus package. How do you make a joke like that when you're defending women from being harassed to make a yuck joke like that? I mean, that was way out of line. Two, you know, Herman Cain hired this new attorney,
L. Lynn Wood,
right? And who's basically dared women, say, you come forward, your whole past will be exposed. And I think this is the problem that women have always faced. Every time they're in a position of raising harassment issues, they're the ones who go on trial.
I think the Cain troops continue to raise the ante on this, not only by hiring a guy like L. Lynn Wood, but also by using such terms as Princess Nancy to refer to the former Speaker of the House.
If you're
But this is a mentality that's being expressed. And the same mentality that would dismiss these women in the manner that he has, troubled woman, you know, just somebody
Gold
who
digger.
remember her face.
They're out to get money. They're,
that,
you know, paycheck.
That kind of attitude
Nancy's
is
paycheck.
also expressed in referring to the person who at the time was Speaker of the House as Princess Nancy. I mean, it all expresses a certain kind of mentality. Now, there's a lot of constituency for that mentality around the country, and Herman Cain is not going to disappear in the polls the way Rick Perry is probably going to disappear in the polls, Hal already has been disappearing in the polls. Herman Cain is going to have a bunker around himself of people who don't think he's done anything wrong, even if some of these allegations are true, and they are going to fight for that because this is their cause, in a sense. They feel themselves personally attacked as well. I think we saw some of that with the students at Oakland University in Michigan in this debate, where they booed Maria Bartiromo when she asked about this, and she asked about it in a way that was highly relevant. Is this the kind of profile that a company wants when it hires a CEO? Is this the kind of profile we want in a president? And he came back at her in very dismissive kind of terms.
The voters have voted with their dollars, and they'll say they don't care about the character assassination. They care about leadership and getting this economy growing and all of the other problems we face.
This is the mentality that is going to circle the wagons around Herman Cain and defend him.
What sticks with me is that every time I get an email from the Romney campaign, they don't mention Herman Cain, or they still talk about Rick Perry and the immigration things and all the things that Rick Perry is doing wrong. So obviously, for all the things that, even though Herman Cain's numbers have not gone down, at least as of yet, I still think that the Romney people would be very happy to be the alternative. I mean, we're always talking about who's the alternative to Mitt Romney. If Mitt Romney's the alternative to Herman Cain, because who else could it be? I mean, if it's not Rick Perry, who could it be? And it's certainly not going to be Newt Gingrich. And you talked about Maria Bartiromo. I mean, his condescending response to what I thought was a very good question.
Would you like to try to explain in simple speak to the American people what you would do after you repeal the president's health care legislation?
In 30 seconds.
Take the time you need, sir. Take the time you need.
I can't take what I need. These guys will all gang up on
me. Do you want to answer the question tonight on health care now?
Give her credit because unlike many debate moderators, she said, look, are you going to answer the question or not? And I thought that was actually one of those missing highlights of the debate that most people don't talk about.
I thought that the moderators in this Oakland University debate in Michigan were probably the best that we've seen through this series of debates. We've now had 10, 11, if you count the one that was just Gingrich and Cain, where they did do a Lincoln-Douglas-style debate. And I think that this continuing process as we go forward into Iowa is not necessarily going to winnow the field any further, but it certainly seems to have winnowed it by one.
We always talk about how the folks in Iowa are demanding attention and demanding respect and demanding love from the candidates. And yet, and we've talked about this before, the fact is who's leading in Iowa, the two candidates who don't show up there at all, Mitt Romney and Herman Cain. Now, so, I mean, Rick Perry was still mired down in fourth or fifth place. I don't know if anybody else in the Oakland University debate, now there are more debates to come, but I don't know if anything what we saw in Michigan helps Rick Santorum, Michelle Bachmann, Ron Paul, John Huntsman even. I mean, even John Huntsman would say these lines and wait for applause that never came. He got maybe an applause, but not even plural of that. I mean, that was about basically it.
Look, I would say until this dynamic changes really dramatically, the only three people who get talked about the day after the debate are whoever made the biggest mistake, and that's been Rick Perry, and Mitt Romney. How does he keep going? How does he seem so unflappable? How does he just keep on being Mitt Romney? And then third, in now, Herman Cain. How did he do? How did he handle the question about sexual allegations and so forth? So it's really getting increasingly impossible for those other people to find any oxygen in that room.
The other news of the week, of course, were the off-year elections, and they were certainly off-year, very disparate bunch of elections, the gubernatorial elections in Kentucky and Mississippi, big city mayor stuff. The big attention was on the bill in Ohio that curtailed collective bargaining for public employee unions that was overwhelmingly voted down.
That really has gotten the attention in part because it represents such a whiplash change from where we were 1 year ago this week in Ohio, where John Kasich had been swept into office, where the Republicans had won a Senate seat.
Everywhere.
And it was
in the House, of course, the state legislature.
Of course, this was a nationwide trend, not so much on the West Coast, but virtually everywhere else in the country,
the
this
real
was
America.
The trend. And it was nowhere more pronounced than in Ohio. So there was a sense, of course, among the Republicans in Ohio and in other places, Wisconsin, that they had it all now and they could do whatever they wanted.
Remember George W. Bush after the 2004 election?
I earned capital in the campaign, political capital, and now I intend to spend it.
And, of course, George W. Bush went out and immediately tried to change Social Security, and even his own party wouldn't follow him in the Congress. And what's happened in these other states, Ohio, Wisconsin, and others, is that they have gone after things like collective bargaining laws as they apply to public employees and changed the law quite dramatically. In Wisconsin, they tried to do something about that by recalling state senators and came up a little bit short of being able to take over the state Senate. But in Ohio, they had this means by which they could put a measure on the ballot this soon, same year that the law was passed, and say, before this law takes effect, do you, the people, approve or do you reject it? And that is dispositive. That's the deal. It wasn't just a referendum. It was absolutely preventing this law from ever taking effect. And the law went down by an overwhelming vote.
Yeah, the fact that it was defeated was not a surprise because the polls had shown that for the longest time. But 61-39 is a thumping that even John Kasich conceded that perhaps there was some indication of overreaching by there. And then they're finished with it. The question really is that what it means for 2012, and everybody, or not everybody, Democrats are saying that John Kasich has awakened the sleeping giant of organized labor and they're going to make a big difference in 2012. That remains to be seen.
That's probably the override of the week.
Yeah, I kind of think that what happened.
And we've all taken part in it to some degree, myself included, in saying, wow, this is a sea change, or at least it smells like a sea change in the air, but I think that can be overread.
Right, and also the fact the same voters overwhelmingly rejected the Obama mandate in a non-binding measure on the Ohio ballot, also by a landslide, even bigger proportion. Now, look, everybody's against the mandate anyway, but again,
The wording on that was, in order to preserve the freedom and independence of Ohioans, it was pretty clear that unless people were implacably opposed to freedom for Ohioans, there was really only one way for them to vote on that.
Well, in some ways, basically, the two results in Ohio and perhaps in Mississippi also with the personhood amendment that went down overwhelmingly.
A little different story, but we'll get
there.
Sure, it's a little
different. We'll get there. It's an overreach, dramatic overreach, that voters said, wait a second, this is a little going too far on the mandate, on collective bargaining, on abortion rights. A
couple of other places, too. You mentioned Mississippi in there. I think it's really the division within the pro-life movement, the anti-abortion movement, wasn't sure whether or not they liked the wording of this personhood thing.
And even Haley Barr.
He voted for it, but said I wasn't really sure which way to go.
And both candidates for governor, both Johnny Dupree, the African-American mayor of Hattiesburg, Mississippi, the first black candidate on a major party ticket for governor of Mississippi, and Phil Bryant, the guy who won overwhelmingly, both supported that measure.
That's right. And it was assumed in the polls that it was going to win. But in the late days, the last couple of weeks, there were actually ads from the anti-abortion side saying don't vote for this. This isn't the best way to get the issue back up to the Supreme Court. Let's not try to overturn Roe versus Wade with the personhood. Let's try to do it another way. And so there's a real split on tactics there, and I think that's probably why at least it was an overwhelming vote. People got confused about it, plus this word fertilization instead of conception, I think, was off-putting to a lot of folks.
It was also a referendum in Maine regarding same-day voting registration. It was also a recall election in Arizona.
This was a shocker.
Well, Russell Pierce, who's basically the face of anti-illegal immigration in Arizona.
And beyond. I mean, a lot of states are trying to pattern their laws on the Arizona law.
The reason everybody is so familiar with what's going on in Arizona is in part because of Russell Pierce. And in the recall election, it was a Republican who beat him, Jerry Lewis, and they love him in France.
They love him in France.
They love him in France.
And the interesting thing is,
ladies!
He's a Republican like Russell Pierce. He's also from Mesa, which is the eastern city just outside, suburban city just outside of Phoenix. And he's also a Mormon. So he's a Mormon from Mesa and a Republican like Russell Pierce. The only thing that was really distinguishing them was he wasn't Russell Pierce. And he didn't have this attachment to this law. And there were also some issues about some free trips that Russell Pierce had taken on the Tostitos Fiesta Bowls money so as to help encourage people to bring their football teams to Arizona.
If nothing else, we did see that both in Mississippi and Arizona, there was the conservatives seemed to be split on tactics.
And yet, with all of this slapping down of the overreaching hand in all of these places, much as we've talked about the disapproval of voters for, in some regards, the overreach of the Obama administration, that was what the 2010 election was supposedly about. At the same time, it was not a total anti-incumbent election by any means. The governor of Kentucky, Stephen Beshear, Democrat, won overwhelming re-election. And in Mississippi, while Haley Barbour was term limited, he was able to basically pass on the governorship office to his lieutenant governor, Phil Bryant, and that was essentially the re-election of Haley Barbour for yet another term.
And add the two other governors that we had last month in Louisiana when Bobby Jindal won overwhelmingly. And in West Virginia where the voters retained their Democratic governor, Earl Ray Tomlin, all four states kept the incumbent party in office.
So here's my question. Where's the voter rage? We talk about voter rage all the time with regard to these referenda, with regard to the polls, with regard to what the voters want and how they're ready to get out the torches and pitchforks. But four governors either get reelected themselves or have their essentially chosen successor anointed in their place.
And look at the mayoral races as well. All the incumbents seem to do very well. No outrage against the sitting or standing mayors in those cities.
And Ed Lee out in San Francisco, even with all that proportional voting and that cumulative voting or whatever you want to call it, this multiple choice thing that people were allowed to do, seems to have won something over 60% when you count in all these second choices, third choices. So he's being returned to office with an overwhelming mandate as well. So mayors don't seem to be making people angry. Governors don't seem to be making people angry. Who's making people angry?
I think the only anger we truly saw was in Ohio, and the Democrats and the labor really came to life. What it means for 2012, we don't know. But, you know, I keep thinking the story of the week is still the meltdown of Rick Perry. And as I was watching Rick Perry with his debate performance, I couldn't help but go back to the 1992 vice presidential debate.
Admiral Stockdale, your opening statement, please, sir.
Who am I? Why am I here?
And of course, the person asking that question, the moderator of that debate, was Hal Bruno. Hal Bruno, the former ABC News political director, who actually was my boss. He's the person who's responsible for bringing me to Washington from New York with ABC News back in 1986.
And that was the only mistake he ever made in right. All those years.
Well,
ABC.
You know, there's something. Well, anyway, Hal Bruno died this week, 83 years old. He was a professional's professional. He was
absolutely
the kind of political director who is constantly on the phone talking to precinct committee men, state chairman. What is happening in your state? What are you hearing? What do you know? What can we tell ABC News? Hal and I, when we were the political unit in Washington, we would talk to World News Tonight, Peter Jennings, Ted Koppel. What people respected about Hal, he was not a blowhard. He was not out to make himself a name. He was not cynical. He was not snarky. He was the kind of guy who believed in the system, cared about honest political coverage. We didn't deal in rumor or innuendo. He would have been aghast at this podcast, probably. But, you know, he passed away this week, and I don't think we're going to see the likes of him in this business ever again.
And that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics.
Oh, right. / politics. There, now I remember.
From NPR.
Dreaming away.